Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. Hey, what's up, everyone? One of the questions we asked in our recent machine learning development and deployment survey was the extent to which respondents' organizations had established a platform to facilitate the delivery of machine learning models. Nearly 85% reported being somewhere on this journey, from not yet having established a platform but working on it, to having one or more environments already in place. With so many organizations investing in building out their machine learning tooling, it's no wonder that the top voted topic at last year's TwiMLCon Unconference was a discussion on whether you should build or buy your data science platform. I'm looking forward to taking on this topic with Kenny Daniel, the CTO of Algorithmia, in an upcoming webinar on Tuesday, June 9th at 10 a.m. Pacific time. I'll be sharing some more insights from our survey, and Kenny and I will be discussing what goes into building a machine learning management platform, how to make the business case for MLOps at your company, and how to evaluate off-the-shelf machine learning management solutions. I hope you can join us. To learn more or register, go to twimlai.com/algorithmia. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone. I am here with Ruman Chowdhury. Ruman is a managing director and global lead of responsible AI at Accenture. Ruman, welcome to the TWIML AI podcast.
Thank you for having me, Sam. This has been a few years in the making, and I'm glad we were able to do this.
You know what? It only takes a global pandemic to make this conversation happen. You know, these are the best conversations, I think, when I'm finally able to connect with friends and, you know, folks I know from the industry. And you and I in particular, I think, have been trying to make this conversation happen for, as you said, a few years. And it's always, oh, well, I'm going to be in Asia. I'm not in the Bay Area. And we haven't quite been able to make it happen. So I'm super, super, super excited.
Me too.
To get this one going. Let's start out as we usually do here on the show and have you share a little bit about your background. You work in ethical and responsible AI. How did you come into that field?
I do. And the answer to that is a lot of meandering. So by background, I'm a data scientist and a social scientist. I would officially say I'm a quantitative social scientist. I have degrees in political science, management, economics, master's in quantitative methods.
Wait, is that one degree or like five or six?
Multiple undergrad degrees.
Oh, I know folks like you.
But I moved to Silicon Valley in 2013 to pursue a job in this like weird little field called data science, which I had heard about anecdotally while in my PhD program at UCSD. Everyone thought I was crazy. Nobody understood why I was leaving a political science PhD program to do some weird tech job. But here we are 7 years later with data science and anything related to data science and AI being the only thing people talk about. So after my stint as a data scientist, I was actually teaching data science at a boot camp called Metis, and that's when Accenture found me. I was doing talks on polling and the elections and in the sense of how numbers and statistics can be misleading because I have a background in things like survey design, polling, and quantitative human behavior analysis. And, you know, Accenture was, this was about 3 years ago, looking for someone to lead this weird thing called responsible AI. And that's how I got this job.
And so you've been at Accenture how long now?
3 years. I actually hit the 3 year mark in early February.
Wow. Nice. Nice.
Which in the responsible AI world makes me ancient. Absolutely ancient.
And you're based in San Francisco. How have things been going for you with shelter in place and COVID and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, San Francisco had a really good response and people, you know, stayed at home and they more or less have been listening. I think everyone's just getting a little bit antsy. So I see more and more people out, although people are still being careful. Fortunately, it's been pretty quiet. I live in Mission Bay, which is near the UCSF hospitals. And, you know, it hasn't been that bad. I live in a really walkable neighborhood. There's parks nearby, etc. So it hasn't been overly unpleasant. I just think this is also the longest amount of time I've ever spent not flying somewhere in the past few years. So it's kind of been nice.
Yeah, I've commented to in fact, just earlier today, like by this time on a normal year, I'd have been probably to half a dozen at least conferences, you know, if not a dozen. And you probably would have been around the world a couple times.
Sure. I mean, it's funny because I have all these placeholders on my calendar and one by one, they all got dropped. But, you know, by now I would have been in London twice, India, and the Nordics. Actually, this week I was supposed to be doing a tour of different Nordic countries to visit different Accenture offices and client partners. And then in a month, I was supposed to be in Atlanta. I still have this thing in Singapore that apparently is still on the calendar for August, but I think they're being ambitious at this point. It's nice to be home. You know, it's nice to be around my pets and organize my apartment and do all those things that one does not get to do.
Nice. So what are you up to at there at Accenture, you know, in responsible AI? What does that mean? What is Accenture's role in responsible AI and how do you help fulfill that?
Yeah, so I have a really interesting and still unique job, although I hope that there will be more jobs that are like mine. My job is to actually provide and create practical client solutions around responsible and ethical use of artificial intelligence. And this can mean anything from data ethics to the unpacking of the black box, as a lot of people call it, or just understandability in models, even to like the strategic organizational structure of companies and how do you create a governance infrastructure. And it's been really fascinating because, as I said, like I got this job through meandering, but what's fascinating is in this job, I use every degree I've ever had, every part of my brain. So, you know, while I do have to tap into my data science skills and think about model explainability, interpretability, different ways of doing data assessments, et cetera, I tap into my social science brain all the time. And I think about human behavior and human responses and how to construct something so that, you know, we're getting accurate data or we're creating policies that are inclusive or understandable. But then also I go to companies and we help them redesign their organizational infrastructure to create the right kind of scaffolding to enable responsible AI. And actually, I've been working with some folks and we have a paper coming out quite soon. We did a workshop at FACT, formerly known as FATSTAR. I've been working with a researcher of mine, Bogdana Markova, Henriette Kramer from Spotify Labs, and Jingying Yang.
I'm a huge fan of Henriette. I haven't seen her in forever.
Oh, because she's super busy, even in the pandemic.
Another conversation just like this. Oh, maybe I should reach out to her and say, hey, you non-pandemic busy or something?
We're sort of non-pandemic busy, but for sure, similar to me, she's on planes less, so that's good. Mm-hmm. So part of my job is the technical deployment, and there's a part of it that's also about the organizational structure and the strategic deployment. Because a big part of the public simply understanding what you're doing with AI is to improve how we communicate what this technology can and cannot do. Because there's a lot of hype, there's a lot of noise, and frankly, there's a lot of backlash to the hype. There's even ethics hype now, frankly. Mm-hmm.
And so I apologize, I got excited when you said Henriette. What was the paper about?
You're like, who, paper, what? Henriette. No, it's fine. So the paper was really interesting because we're at this phase in responsible AI or ethics where there are principles, like there are so many principles, we're drowning in principles, right? Algorithm Watch keeps this database. I think right now they have 150 plus principles of AI and ethics from organizations like the OECD down to companies like Telefonica or even Accenture.
Say 150 principles, are these 150 kind of published frameworks by some group or company, or 150, if you want to be ethical, you need to do things 1 through 150?
I got it. So 150 different sets of principles. So different organizations that have come up. But to your point, interestingly, there have been a few papers trying to understand what are common themes across principles, so like a meta-analysis. So Anna Jobin has one, Luciano Floridi and Josh Cowles have another. And there are some themes that are pretty common. I can't remember them all off the top of my head, but stuff like non-malfeasance and, there's like sort of five or six common themes that Floridi and Cowles find. So it's interesting. So to your point, everyone's talking about it, but there are common themes to it in general. And the big thing now is, how do we drive principles into action? How do we do stuff with this? And our paper was about, how do you enable the right sort of organizational structure? So drawing from, like I said, I use every part of my brain, drawing from like management literature, thinking through organizational analysis, organizational structure, how do we draw from those principles to understand the kinds of shifts companies need to make to enable the people they've hired to institute responsible AI. So we did hour-long surveys with 24 different people across 18 different companies. And we specifically focused on people like myself, who are there for the application, not just the research. Found a lot of really, really interesting things.
Interesting. Yeah. In fact, the last time I reached out to Henriette was in advance of our conference, TWML's conference in the fall. And we did a panel on operationalizing AI ethics. So, for organizations that are, trying to implement AI and do it responsibly, what are some of the things that they could do? And, we got into this long back and forth email conversation about how it's all evolving.
And that's actually what the paper is about. It's about how we're in this critical inflection point where there's this whole organizational literature about external and internal pressures in organizations that enable ethical change. And right now we have a significant amount of external pressure. And it's all just like, it just takes time, right? You just have to do the things. And it took a while for the community to evolve, for people to make principles, people to start talking about them, the media engagement, public awareness. And now it's reached this point where companies are getting this pressure. And we also have internal champions and companies trying to drive this change. So, how can we utilize this internal and external, this external pressure to enable the internal champions to do their job? And what can companies do to help them? Absolutely. So we look at the current state, which is kind of where things are today, the prevalent state, which is, in the immediate future, where are things likely to go? And then this ideal future state, like, where would people love things to be in the future? What is this ideal state of a responsible company?
For a while, I would hear about organizations that were taking this position that, we're just not going to pursue AI because it's too ethically fraught and we don't know what to do. Do you see that at all? Or had you seen that? Is it still something that you come across?
I have definitely seen that sentiment when it comes to individual projects. I think every company is really excited about the promise of AI. And I don't think anybody is turning down, the whole concept in general. I mean, frankly, you just won't be a market leader. Yeah, you right. kind of can't. However, yes, I have seen hesitation when it comes to implementing certain projects. And it's definitely a blocker in companies scaling AI. One thing we find in general as a company, as Accenture, there are many blockers to scaling artificial intelligence. Companies are drowning in proof of concept. Anybody can spin up a proof of concept based on a nice database. They find, some sort of online data, do some fancy neural net on it. You can have data science spin something up in 3 weeks. But productionalizing it, scaling it, is a whole other endeavor.
Yeah. And so part of you've kind of talked about all these different parts of your brain that come into play when trying to help organizations think through this. Do most organizations already have the kind of pieces in place to build to build ethics into the way they operationalize machine learning? Like, if you're in financial services, for example, you've had to deal with making loan decisions ethically and things like that, so you probably have some kind of some governance structure in place. How prevalent is that? And what are the things, even if you have that you need to do to make it make sense in the context of ML and AI?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And the answer is it just varies a lot. And some of it is the culture of the organization or the company, and some of it is just the nature of the industry that it's in. I would say my rule of thumb for, you know, thinking through which companies are, you know, would be the most successful at enabling responsibly, at least at this point, one would be understanding AI output as probabilistic and not deterministic. So understanding the math and statistics behind it, rather than thinking of it as a magical computational outcome, just helps someone in my position a lot, because a lot of the bias and unfairness from artificial intelligence arises from the fact that, you know, if you understand that this that the output is a likelihood and not a certainty, then you can appreciate bias in, you know, in a almost like a technical sense, the way data scientists think about bias. And then you can appreciate how bias can enter in a system and think of, you know, how to remove that bias. Second would be some sort of adoption of, you know, use of AI in your organization already. It's difficult if you're, again, like you think this is like some sort of magical technology. The third, interestingly, is either develop legal functions or regulated industry. And not just because of external pressures like regulators, but companies that are in industries that are highly regulated have legal functions that are already dedicated. They've already started building that infrastructure. So if I were to talk to a company, you know, in a less regulated industry, their lawyers are usually more like contract lawyers or, you know, certain types of maybe like litigation lawyers, but they haven't had to actually work with ethics and compliance necessarily, and not necessarily in that developed of a sense. Although I really do think this notion of risk functions and the value of something like a chief risk officer is going to change quite a bit, and that role will be increasingly valuable, you know, as we adopt more artificial intelligence. So to your point about financial services, they're my favorite customers in the sense that, like,
I mean, they're ready to
roll, like they get it. Also, yeah. I mean, so marginal amount of bias, like, because I am a statistician also by background, like, you know, like I think a lot of, anecdotally, I'll say a lot of statisticians who work at these financial services organizations got a little bit marginalized by the rise of data science, because people did not, because again, it was sort of sold as this magical computer thing, not a bunch of math. And the statisticians are like, no, we've been doing this for a long time. And I wholeheartedly agree, they have been doing this for a long time. So they understand models, they understand how to assess them. They understand that accuracy isn't the only thing to look at when you look at models, you know, and this notion of testing, it's all like they get all of it. But also the industry itself has this culture of ethics that comes about post the 2008 financial crisis. And this really interesting document called SR 117. And it was written by the Federal Reserve on my birthday in 2011. And if you were to read that document, you would be like, it reads as if like someone like you or me wrote this today about the issues with models, the need for ethical use, irresponsible use of data, and appropriate use of models. It's fascinating because they were thinking about this 10 years ago, and there's a lot we can learn. And certainly artificial intelligence introduces new challenges, but the building blocks are there. But and it's probably the most robust in financial services than anywhere else.
When I think about ethics, and one of the challenges of, you know, just trying to address it, you know, organizationally, I guess I can characterize it as like you've got this one side that's like idealistic, and this another side that's kind of very practical. And I'm wondering, you know, do we lose something when we kind of hand over this concept of ethics to lawyers and risk management people?
I think that there is an evolution of the risk function that's probably going to happen. And you're right. When I think about this work, I try to broaden the phrase to be about risk and impact. And I do agree there's a cynical take on risk, which is more about, you know, how do we
get as close to the line as possible?
Yeah, or also like, yeah, risk as not liability. But I will say, working with a lot of folks who are in this field, I think there is this desire. So, you know, going back to financial services, a lot of what exists today as model risk management started from this conference, this this gathering called Basel, and there's Basel 1, 2, 3, like these different mm-hmm. documents. And it's not just about like, here's how you audit a model. It's actually about how do you make an ethical company? And they thought about things like compensation for employees being linked to performance, which would then create incentives for them to either misrepresent or lie about what's going on, right? And not to say it's been perfect. I mean, there have been some notable disasters since then. But the intent is there. And maybe this is, you know, a good motivator for the people who are truly dedicated. But you're right. I like to expand the language to move beyond risk to impact. I think impact is more proactive. I think impact thinks more broadly. And impact also isn't focused on like, how do we shift the liability from me to someone else? Because theoretically, in a pure risk function, I can just say like, well, my organization's risk is X. And if that person's absorbing the risk, then my risk is lower. That doesn't mean that people didn't get harmed. It just means I'm not being sued, right? That's a more cynical take. But then bringing in the language of impact broadens it to mean like, no, you are actually socially responsible to, you know, the environment at large, whether it's the market, whether it's society or your customers.
So if you're an organization that is kind of down the path of exploring machine learning, maybe you have, you know, one or n of these prototypes that you've mentioned, and you're starting to operationalize ML technically, and you're listening to this interview and you're like, oh, ethics, I need to
I
need to get me some of that. First of all, kind of what do you do there? But also, you know, I think you mentioned in like thinking about these problems, you're using all these different kind of parts of your brain, your management mm-hmm. part of your brain, your social sciences part of your brain, your technical part of your brain. You know, when I think about, you know, kind of me, I've got a little bit of management part of my brain from kind of, you know, industry. I've got a technical part of my brain. But like when I was in school, I went to an engineering school. RPI, Go Engineers.
Okay.
Yeah. I took like maybe 2 social science classes in the whole time. So like there, I don't have that formal training to draw on. And there are a lot of people in industry that don't, you know, what does the path look like to start to understand, you know, maybe kind of encapsulate the room on social sciences, you know, brain or what have you.
Yeah,
So you can really, you know, if not rigorously, thoughtfully think through these kinds of issues and put a structure in place so that you can do it repeatably and start to scale it.
So 2 thoughts. One is the first talk I ever wrote at Accenture, I actually still give it today, and it's called What Do We Talk About When We Talk About Bias? And what I realized is that when data scientists were communicating with non-data scientists, there was this like lost in translation moment about some of the most basic terms, like bias is one. And to your point about, you know, going to a purely technical school where you didn't really take social science classes, when I was teaching at Metis, I realized that my students that came from pure STEM backgrounds had no concept that data could be biased because, you know, for them, data represented an objective truth. And it's something that you sort of rationally.
We never see that argument on Twitter today.
No, not at all.
Never happens.
No, never. But it's interesting because it's sort of anecdotally people get it, but then, you know, and I understand, like, if you're a computer scientist or a mathematician, you've always optimized to a data set, right? And explaining to them that the collection of data can be flawed was just like this interesting aha moment. And you know, that's where some of my early work on this stuff comes from. And it's still, like, you know, I told you I wrote that talk over three years ago at this point. I still give it today. And still people are like, oh yeah, actually that's true. Sorry, it's my dog. Okay. Pets are unavoidable in the pandemic. Pets and children are unavoidable in the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
I've had too many calls with someone's child that really ran in. It was very cute. It's always very cute.
Just earlier today, I was watching the Microsoft Build technical keynote, and Scott Hanselman, do you know Scott?
Mm-mm.
He was giving a, you know, longtime kind of blogger inspiration, kind of champion of diversity in tech, all this stuff. Shout out to Scott. Mm-hmm. But he was doing his keynote in front of who knows how many, you know, virtual tens of thousands of people. And his kid sneaks into the back of his office.
I love it.
Where
I
he's
love
recording
all of it.
To steal some toy.
You know what? I love it. It's so humanizing.
I agree.
It's like, look, life happens. It's fine. We all work. We're not automatons. Like, you know, we have pets, we have children, we have lives, we're humans. I think it's great.
Yep.
But back to your question, if I could reconstruct the world, I think data science, much like quantitative finance, frankly, should actually have an arm called critical data science, that there should be people trained in data science field in the art of critiquing data science models. I think it is way too complex, frankly, for an individual to just do as an add-on to their everyday project. And also, it's hard to have that level of objectivity when you're auditing your own work, right? Because everybody likes to think they did a good job, and maybe you did, maybe you didn't, and you know, there are things you would miss. So a large part of like what people are saying when they say, how do we institute this, like a lot of folks call for things like red teams, drawing from like the way security works. Well, in order to do that, you kind of need this like third party of people, whether it's another organization or whether it's people within your organization, but they need to have this like specialized skill set of being able to like assess models for robustness in all sorts of ways, right? Whether it's how the data was collected, to like literally the parameters of the model, and even to like where you will be implementing and who it will be used on, whether it is well suited for those individuals, right? So that would be my, like, if I could change the world, I would add something called critical data science as an actual field of study within data science. But for today, I think that people sometimes forget that quantitative social sciences scientists exist, and that's literally what we've done, like our whole lives. And it was interesting when I first moved here, like, I got a lot of flack for not being a programmer. And I just did not, like, I always like to say I'm not born of tech. I was not built and created here. I was 33 when I moved here. So I wasn't like this young green kid, like learning about how, you know, places should be. And I'm like, why is everybody so obsessed with programming? And it's just, it's obviously a great skill to have, but for me, it was one of many skills. I didn't necessarily think it was more valuable than other skills, and this sort of weird tiering of what's more or less valuable is very odd to me. And then, you know, like it was interesting because it's, you know, you certainly get a lot of flack for being a social scientist in this world, but you know, now it's interesting because all of my quantitative social science skills come into play. So, you know, I think one is just bring in more social scientists on your team. You would be amazed and surprised at our level of statistical and quantitative skill and abilities and our programming skills. We can do all of it. But, you know, to be fair, like, there's plenty of things engineers do that I can't do, right? But the whole goal is to make this an interdisciplinary group. I actually don't think any one group or body can do this. Like, I certainly personally cannot do all of it. It's supposed to be my job kind of at a high level, right? The more you dig into it, the more you realize how there's a role for everyone to play. So thinking through, you know, the study that I did with like Henriette and Jingying and Bobby, that's actually the answer. It's like the entire organization is responsible and everybody has their job to do. And I can appreciate how it's an extremely daunting task if you are a data scientist on a project. You know, there's always this literature of data scientists as if they're gods, as if like, you know, and I remember my first job as a data scientist, like, you're not a god. You're responding to someone else's demands. You got to meet deadlines, right? I mean, it actually takes a pretty brave person to say, you know, we need to put this project on hold because this data is wrong or incomplete, or to go to your project manager and say, like, you know, this product is not built ethically, and we need to create the right sort of incentives and community structures to do so. It's a very, you know, like, I suppose, high level answer to your question. Sorry, I don't have an easy answer to it. I think it's fine that, you know, it's totally fine that people are offering ethics, curricula, et cetera. I think it's certainly needed, but is it going to solve the problem? No, it's not.
And I think it's a great point. And you know, one of the biggest things that's changed in data science over the past, you know, 3-5 or so years is kind of this move away from thinking of the data scientist as this kind of, you know, lone ninja that kind of roams the night.
That job was never that. Like, this whole, like, weird 10% engineer thing. I'm like, who is that? Who are you? I don't know. Like, honestly, I don't know data scientists who are like that. I don't know who these people are. I've certainly never worked with one. And, you know, And if they existed, nobody ever liked them, and they were actually never very productive.
I remember these, it's a myth. Like, these pictures that you that we used to see with like the data scientists and like all of the skills in their backpacks. And,
that's right.
You remember what I'm talking about?
My favorite used to be these job descriptions, and you can still find them. And it'll be like, you know, computer science degree, PhD preferred, 10 years plus engineering, knowledge of like everything.
All of the industry stuff.
All of it. And I'm like, this person doesn't exist. And like, and then they'll also say something like, you know, back in 2015, it would say like 6 to 10 years of experience in data science. I'm like, that term didn't exist 10 years ago, but okay. Right. Go back to like Yahoo and go find the like OG data scientist. Maybe one of them is qualified.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, but to your point, actually, at my first job, their first data science hire was actually somebody from Yahoo who was one of their original data scientists. And like, he certainly wasn't that way. He was a great teacher, a wonderful person to work with, taught me a lot about how to productionalize code. That was one of the things I didn't know how to do. I mean, I knew how to like assess models and build it in like this closed environment, but how do you take it and, you know, make it ready for an engineering team? So these were skills I didn't have. And Sajid was really helpful and like a wonderful person to work with. So I have no idea where that weird myth comes from.
Interesting. But I think by and large, organizations with few exceptions have kind of moved away from that towards more of a team approach. Mm-hmm. Stitch Fix comes to mind as a counterexample, mm-hmm. where they are very much, you know, they still look for a full stack data scientist, they call them. But in general, you know, I tend to see more of kind of a team approach that has specialists. And I think to your point, you know, ethics or, you know, computational social science thinking or however we want to call it is a, you know, it's a complementary skill that belongs on that team, as opposed to, you know, we have to, you know, make everyone social science ninjas in addition to being technical ninjas and deployment ninjas.
It's one of those things where the field just had to mature, right?
Yeah.
And the analogy that I always think of is like, remember the title webmaster from the 90s? try to tell anybody born after the year 2000 that once upon a time, companies would hire one person to manage their website, the whole thing. This included graphics, design, and now it's, and not only is it a team, it is a team of people who are like graphics designers, like, you know, and pure creative folks, to engineers and programmers, to somebody who's just developing content and really good at writing copy and messaging, you know. And it's I think that over time, I mean, it took a while to get there, and that's where it went, because it was just logical. You know, our web presence became just as important, if not sometimes more so, than a physical presence for any given company. If you wanted to do it right, you had to invest in people. Guess what? With interdisciplinary skill sets, and you couldn't just write, you know, this job description of someone who knew HTML, CSS, and you know, do you know a color palette? You know, just don't make this website in Windings ever.
Comic Sans and Windings for the win.
Oh man!
Beyond kind of the ethics, you know, should we, shouldn't we? You know, not to oversimplify ethics. I guess I want to transition to kind of explainability and the extent to which that comes up in your work and is a concern for the people that you are working with. And assuming so, you know, what are you seeing as kind of the ways that folks are addressing it?
Yeah, it's interesting. So the notions of both explainability and transparency come about in part because of a lot of the legislation from the EU, so General Data Protection Regulation. And it's been interesting to see how people interpret it. So like another talk that I give is about both the notion of explainability and transparency. The idea of explaining, just the concept of what it means to explain, is really interesting, right? So again, like tapping into this other part of my brain, this is where I draw on like political philosophy and you know, governance and democracy, right? So, you know, we want to create all this governance around AI, and we want to like explain things, right? But often explainability is this notion that I'm just going to tell you things, and somehow you're supposed to understand what I'm saying. So the idea would be like this panoptic, like teacher in a lecture hall kind of thing. Like I'm standing in front of a room, I'm putting up these lectures. If you don't get it, it's your fault, and you got to figure it out. And the So sometimes like our notion of explainability, because we translate from data science to, you know, other fields, whether it's a customer service representative or a loan officer or a judge, right? These are other people who have no interest or skills or abilities in our field, same way we don't have any interest, skill, or ability in their fields, right? So what are we, like, how are we explaining things? And you know, as it was a more concrete technical example I use is the end user license agreement. So, you know, we've all gone through, we update our OS, and then we get this like long legalese document, which none of us read. And even if we sat down and read it, we would not understand it because it's written by lawyers for lawyers.
Right.
So fully explained, completely explained, not at all understood. Mm-hmm. And often when I think about explainability, I think about the notion of understanding and how, you know, if you're a good teacher, you're really focused on whether or not you students have understood what you've said, right? And, mm-hmm. and even if it means explaining it again or explaining it differently or, you know, taking more effort to understand your audience rather than kind of just saying it the way you would say it. So that would be sort of the governance component of it. And even this notion of transparency, right? So similarly, transparency assumes that if I have a quote transparent process or a transparent model, that it's great, that's it, I'm done. There's this assumption there that I can do something about it. And all systems are inherently have a power dynamic. So if a massive tech corporation just says, by the way, we've changed our models to be like X, what are you or I or the average person would we be able to do? Nothing, right? Absolutely nothing. And this came up quite a bit thinking about like image, like facial recognition, image detection. One pushback I would get from people, you know, on the use of facial recognition in stores, et cetera, to maybe like identify a shoplifter, none of that weird behavioral, you know, effective computing stuff. I just mean like straight up like identifying someone from a video. And they would say, well, what's the difference between that and having a security guard? And I'm like, well, the difference is if there's a security guard and they've unfairly targeted me, I can ask who's your, like, I want to talk to your manager. I can call the company. I can actually take action. But if it is a image recognition system and it incorrectly maps my face to somebody else who was stealing, I actually have no agency, I have no form of redress. So I can have full transparency. I know there was facial recognition, I know it was used, but actually I don't have any agency. So this critical missing part of transparency is an agency. But from like a technical perspective, I think there's a lot of really cool stuff going on. Like I really love a lot of the way adversarial models are being used to understand model explainability. There are a lot of the mimic models, right, where you have this like, student teacher model. I think there's a lot of really cool stuff going on there. And I'm super excited to see more of it being used in production. And like, again, going back to this notion of proof of concept versus production, it's actually really hard to move some of the more advanced models into a way where a big corporation or even like a medium-sized company could use it. Like they're conceptually really interesting, but you know, just like how long it takes to run one of those assessments is sometimes a deal breaker.
To run the model or an assessment of the model because of its lack of transparency?
The complexity of an explainability model. Mm-hmm. So for example, like some of the models on counterfactual fairness would have to iterate across every single potential scenario that could happen with the data in order to compute what would happen if someone's gender was switched from male to female, right? Those things take a while. And maybe it works if you have like 10 variables, 15 variables. It's really hard if you have like 300 variables.
Mm-hmm. What other interesting things are you seeing happening in the field that will kind of, you know, are most likely to impact your customers, your clients? You know, I think there's a lot of conversations happening in the field that kind of range in their practicality and pragmatism. And I'm curious about the more pragmatic side of that.
Yeah, me too. like I was saying, I started the shop 3 years ago. I used to have a slide on every single one of my decks, like every single one, I swear, because I just got so tired of it. I would start every talk by saying there are three things I don't talk about. Mm-hmm. And my three things were Terminator, HAL, and Silicon Valley entrepreneurs saving the world. Because at that time, we had a rosier view of, oh, yeah. But I said every, because like, I swear to God, if someone sucked me into the HAL conversation, I was going to lose my mind.
Uh-huh. and so is that to say that, you know, just kind of putting pause on the previous question, is that to say that you don't get involved in like, and do your customers even care about like the AI safety kinds of questions and
like paperclip maximizing kinds of questions?
Yeah.
Like maybe for like intellectual curiosity, sure. Right. And I
think paperclip reference for those that are not following is a reference to Peter Bostrom, and we'll drop an analogy that he gives, and we'll drop a link to my podcast with Peter in the show notes.
Oh, cool. You did a podcast and that's really awesome.
Yeah. Cool. I'm pretty sure we talked about the paperclip thing too.
I would be surprised if you didn't, but yeah, I mean, I think yes, out of intellectual curiosity, sure. But I think we may actually slowly be moving into a scarier world than we were before, particularly with some of the uses of AI in human resources, which is interesting because it's not this like super sexy field of, oh yeah, you know, autonomous vehicles, da-da-da. The first field where we're actually addressing some of these like more existential ethical concerns has been in HR because of the rise of effective computing and this concept that you can somehow measure someone's potential by their face or by their expressions or by their mannerisms. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, and it's, you know, in retrospect, it's actually not surprising because when we hire somebody, it is such a nebulous and difficult to quantify factor that we hire people on, right? Like sometimes mm-hmm. it's likability, frankly, right? We like to think it's based, and even if we're being really rigorous about it, it's often based on potential. And you may have a different interpretation of someone's potential than I do. And it's like almost an inherently a biased process. So but yet it is a world in which there's clearly a need for some sort of automation, whether just in sheer amount of volume that companies have to deal with, or, you know, mitigating the bias that already exists. So it's interesting and kind of a difficult problem. And some of the answers have brought in new, weird, ethical, existential problems. But in general, no, not really. Thank goodness. I mean, well, and I say that because not that I'm not interested in the philosophical conversations, but sometimes it detracts from it is a way of avoiding the actual problems that exist.
Right. Right.
Right. Which are, by the way, none of these are new problems. These are problems that people have, you know, the first thing you realize in any of these ethical conversations about AI is that these are the same problems that have existed in society. They're just maybe more shoved in our face because they can happen faster and at scale.
Right. Right. So I don't remember the previous question, so we'll just keep going with this HR thing. and that's an example of, I think there are, you know, there are, I think, a range of reactions to ideas like AI and machine learning assisted hiring and, you know, computer vision as a kind of broad class of applications. And you see reactions ranging from, the technology is just a hammer. The hammer didn't kill anyone. It was the person that used the hammer that killed someone. To, you know, the technology is, the root of the evil, and we should not use, you know, technology X for problem Y.
Right.
And I'm curious how you personally kind of parse those kinds of arguments, and also how you lead folks through a process to figure out, you know, what makes sense for them.
Mm-hmm. This is why I really like talking to my lawyer friends. Seriously, I've actually learned a lot from legal people, whether it's like,
I thought you were about to run into a disclosure.
No. These are actually questions that, you know, they've thought of. So the big question is always, who has the liability? And in some sense, when someone says, oh, technology is just the hammer, they're kind of saying like technology is not liable. Right.
I'm not liable.
Right. Or I'm just the engineer, like I'm not liable, et cetera. Right. And it is an interesting conundrum, even from like a a legal liability perspective. Like, okay, I think we can more or less agree that we can't hold an AI or a model liable. So fine, is it the data scientist? Is it the company? And if so, who at the company? And that's not really a solved problem. I think there was a lot of discussion around the Uber self-driving car incident, right? Where the Uber self-driving car hit this woman on the road, mm-hmm. and there was this, like, hot potato of who's liable. So it turned out that the instruments had been tuned in a particular way that it didn't actually see her, or it didn't pick her up as like an object moving that it should avoid. If it were tuned a different way, it could have, by the way. So I think that's a really interesting point. I know at one point they were talking about how, well, the woman driving, who was the test driver, should have been paying better attention. But, you know, one can make a pretty easy argument that if you're in an autonomous vehicle, it's really hard to be constantly paying attention.
Test designed for failure.
Yeah, and just to have the level of, like, quick response and reaction that you need to, if you're, you know, you can't be on alert when you're not doing anything for hours at a time. So, you know, and I actually don't know where that netted. So I'd be curious. But on the other end, like just thinking about, you know, like the notion of technology being neutral, like it's such a, again, the social science, such a silly concept, because everything we build is imbued with our values, just literally just by creating something, because we built it in a way just to solve a problem. And sometimes I like to use, you know, maybe non-values laden examples. I think people get very emotionally polarized one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you a really good example and like how I thought about this myself. So I was in the Nordics in January and I had to go to this event and I was using like whatever maps on my phone, right? And I go outside and it's like, I don't know, like negative 30 or some insane temperature, right? And like in 2 minutes, my phone completely bricks. Like it dies. Like I'm watching the battery go to zero and it dies. And I'm like, what's going on? And then I go to the event I'm going to and I'm like, hey, something's wrong with my phone. I'm really sorry. I'm late. Da-da-da. And they're like, oh yeah, yeah, that happens. Apparently, at a particular temperature and below that temperature, smartphone batteries die. And mm-hmm. all you have to do, so everybody has their own solutions for it. Like they have little, like, they stick them in their mittens or whatever, or and then also you just need to recharge it for a few minutes and it brings your battery back to full power. And I thought that was really interesting because I'm like, you know, that to me doesn't sound like an intractable problem. But if I were developing this technology in Cupertino, California, where it is never below 30 degrees, I probably wouldn't see that. I probably would never have thought of that problem as, you know, something I would address. And I thought it was really interesting that, like, I have a watch that knows what kind of swim stroke I'm doing, whether it's a backstroke or a butterfly or a, you know, freestyle or whatever. Mm-hmm. But my phone, this phone for a significant population of the world completely freezes in a temperature that's actually not very unusual for where they are. And, you know, all that is to say, like, everything we build has values. We choose to prioritize certain things over others. So it's odd to say that, like, it's fundamentally, like, not values driven. And yes, there are parallels to be made with, like, you know, the creation of nuclear energy, et cetera, right? A lot of people use the Manhattan Project when thinking about things like liability or responsibility. But ultimately, you know, it is our responsibility because we do make these things, right? And the things that we make are taken and used by people. And yes, we can't control how everyone's going to use what we've built. But I do think creating a culture of responsibility is absolutely critical and necessary.
I'm trying to think through whether that answered my question at all.
It did not.
Right. Well, and you know, and I think there's an argument that, you know, you live in a domain to which there aren't answers to, you know, answers the way, you know, that, you know, there may be answers to questions that, you know, engineers might find.
And I think sometimes it's fine. Like, I think the act of interrogation, the act of understanding is is actually sometimes the thing that brings you to where you want to be. Because a lot of these things are like personal choices, right? Personal values. And sometimes it's hard to have these conversations because they do end up being values laden. So we did this survey about a year ago at Accenture called the Gray Area Survey. Mm-hmm. And rather than ask these like really obvious questions, like should the AI kill person A or B, they were like kind of something that was a lot more difficult to answer. So one, you know, one that I think was interesting was, you know, are companies responsible for not having surge pricing if there is a potential threat of a disaster? And that actually happened to me because I was in London and it was crazy. I was like walking down Bond Street and then all of a sudden this flood of people come running at me. And it turns out that there was a scare where they thought there was somebody with a gun. Turned out to not be. But then none of us could leave because everyone was trying to get a car and prices for like Ubers, et cetera, were like absolutely insane. Or it's like £300, right? But then that leads to the question, like, is it a company's responsibility to you know, make their models such that if there's a threat of an attack that, you know, they don't have search, is that unsafe? Is that unfair? I don't know what the answer is to that, right? Another one would be, you know, in a search engine, if you search for CEO, you're largely going to get white men who are over the age of 40. Is that fair or unfair? Is it ethical or unethical? You could say, well, it's the ground truth. That's what it is. You know, most CEOs in the world are old white men named John, literally. Or there's certainly an argument to be made that, you know, just because you're searching CEO doesn't necessarily mean you have to be told a biased truth. And maybe it can be more as maybe we can show images of people who are CEOs who don't fit that singular mold. And again, that's a values solution. That's not, there is no right answer to some of these things. And I think part of it's actually being comfortable with the fact that there are no single answers to a lot of these questions.
Yeah. I think the example that was maybe floating around in the back of my mind was the, I forget the name of the individual, but one of the developers of YOLO, which is a object detection library, announced on Twitter, hey, this computer vision thing is scary. I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. And it was a, right.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, that's the thing about like somebody creating a technology, absolving themselves of responsibility, it sends a message of indifference. Going back to this notion of like power structure, you know, it doesn't matter if I personally, me, Rahman, say, I don't want to use computer vision technology. It's like, okay, you know, whatever. But if the person who literally created it says, you know what, like, this is not something I can like be behind anymore. And I'm horrified by how this has been used. That is such a powerful message to send, you know, and it's very clear that something needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, with something like that as kind of background or context, like how do you walk through, you know, personally, where you draw the line, or, you know, say you're an engineer at place X, you know, is there an answer for, you know, where I'm going? You've had this conversation a hundred times.
Yeah.
Is it just like, you know, go off on a mountain and like, you know, sit in the position?
It's tough. And like, actually, I had like a bit of a, like an existential crisis last year and thinking through exactly these decisions, right? You know, one can arrive at the conclusion that inherently all capitalism is evil, right? Like, you know, this notion that there's no such thing as an ethical company. And then I had this really great book recommended to me, and it's called Against Purity. It has nothing to do with ethics and AI. It actually has to do with, you know, movements that are about, you know, sort of a like a moral good, and how this sort of this idea of the most pure or the most good is actually detrimental to the cause. And the author actually uses climate change and the environmental movements to talk about how it can be harmful if we're just trying to like out ethics each other. And you do see it sometimes. You know, this idea of like who's better than someone else because person X works at evil company Y. You know, I mean, you know, I can get flack because I work at Accenture, right? Does that mean that everything I do is, you know, nullified or tainted? And you know, I don't. I would like to think that's not the best way to approach it because, frankly, you do end up in a race to the bottom, right? Where everybody has to be more ethical or more good than the other person or more pure than the other person. And it's just not a helpful, discussion.
How ethical is it to be the ethics police that, you know, thinks they're superior to everybody?
Exactly. Which actually, interestingly, like when I think about AI governance, I worry about this a lot. So again, like thinking about everything you learned about states, markets, and democracy, often the way we do AI governance, like, and everyone's doing the same thing. You get a group of quote experts together. These are all like folks like me, right? And we all sit in a room and we just decide what ethics is. It's very strange and problematic. And if someone were to create a government that way, we would call it an authoritarian regime. We would actually not call it a democracy. So it's interesting that I have seen very few democratic processes being built around governance. And interestingly, I think corporations would be the first ones to actually do that if they do it right.
Interesting. Well, I appreciate the subtitle of this book you're recommending, Against Purity, Living Ethically in Compromised Times. Mm-hmm. I think we can all relate to some aspect of that or another. What else is going on? Anything else that we should be sure to cover, or any pearls of wisdom for us? Other books that we should be?
Oh man, I was like literally looking at my book. I'm like, what's going on over here? I don't know. What am I reading? I was reading. Actually, my laptop is like propped up on this book called "The Essentials of Risk Management." 600 pages on financial risk management.
Hard pass.
I thought it was a really interesting book, like making those parallels. I tried reading Gödel, Escher, Bach, right? It made me go to sleep. It's supposed to be one of those, one of those classics of, you know, thinking through computing, et cetera. And, like, I guess I'm not smart enough for it, so I don't know. I mean, like, I thought it was fine. Like, the anecdotes are kind of cool, but, like, I can't read, like, 1,000 pages of, like, disjointed anecdotes. It was kind of rough. I suppose, like, for the nth time, STEM people are, like, we are Columbusing social sciences. I don't know if you, I found something today where it just sort of boggles my mind where, you know, this whole field can just decide, like, oh, wow, behavioral sciences, we're the ones who discovered it. And I'm like, social sciences, we exist.
Well, wasn't that example, there was something, I don't know, maybe six months ago or something, where someone wrote this article that got a lot of publicity. It was like, oh, we should have a field of study that does X, Y, Z. And everyone was like, oh yeah, that exists. We've been doing that for.
Yeah. I mean, without naming names, because, you know, like, this person is a very nice individual. But I, like, was talking to somebody pretty high up at a major tech company leading AI, and he had never heard of the field of HCI or STS. Never heard of it, but he was incredibly proud of the fact that he had just hired an ethicist to advise him. And I'm like, so you hired a philosopher to advise you, but you've never heard of STS or HCI. Cool.
STS being Science and Technology Studies, and HTI, Human Computer Interaction.
Yes. I was like, good luck with your platform.
Yeah.
I mean, like, and the thing is, like, it's not to belittle the people who are trying, right? I think that there is this inherent ego about tech that I found, like, actually, like, mind-boggling when I moved here. I just never been in a field where everyone just thought they were gods. I thought it was very strange. But hey, I come from the lowly social sciences. I worked in public policy and nonprofits before, you know, I was an economist for a minute, you know, like, I just never worked in a field where literally people thought that they just did everything better than everybody else. And they say that as a data scientist, you know, I didn't understand, and I still don't, this idea that programming is better than everything, or that technology is, you know, this notion of technological solutionism. And I think, you know, it's kind of being brought to the forefront the more we build artificial intelligence technologies, right? Like that we can't automate away human behavior and human preferences. And actually, I'd mentioned Bobby and I have a paper on something I was working on called technological determinism, and specifically thinking through recommendation systems and how they might nudge you to kind of be the same person forever. And they don't really encourage you to explore and expand your horizons simply because of the way they're constructed, right? A recommendation system takes your prior behavior, maps that, you know, who you are to an assessment of people who are, quote, like you, and gives you recommendations based on things you might like, given other people who are profiled the same as you. Yeah. That to me is actually kind of scary.
A lot of conversation around this in the context of, you know, it actually, this conversation gets more prevalent kind of every kind of political, you know, election cycle, right? As we start talking about filter bubbles and things like that, and monocultures and.
Yeah. I mean, filter bubbles are kind of a more extreme example, but I'm even thinking of, like, I don't know. I think a lot, like, I fortunately went to college and did all my stupid things before these ways existed of tracking and tracing. God forbid there be a Facebook when I was in college or here. That would not be good. But I wonder about these kids, you know, but in college, you know, back in the olden times, was an interesting way to sort of reinvent yourself, right? To think of yourself as like, just get like a fresh start. And I feel like sometimes for younger people, like you can't ever escape who you are and where you're from. And you can't ever be someone else or think of the world in a different way, right? Because like you'll have this weird baggage, this technological baggage with you forever. And I find that kind of sad. And I think about like how much I have changed and how much it's part of, you know, human nature to change over time. Like we're supposed to evolve. We're supposed to be weird and different. You know, I worry a lot about the homogeneity that comes with tech. And I wonder whether, you know, a social scientist or political scientist in the middle of her PhD program today could even possibly enter the field of data science, right? Because, you know, whether or not it's because these job ad platforms or these, you know, these NLP-based engines that match resumes with jobs would just not think I was qualified or didn't know what I was doing, or I just didn't fit someone's paradigm, and I built my life and not fitting other people's paradigms. And I worry very much about like how people can still be individuals and be curious and just learn other things, even though the internet has given us basically unlimited access to things. I wonder if, you know, in a sense, we may actually stifle all that possibility by thinking that like everything is this repeat cycle of behavior, that we can predict patterns and these patterns are deterministic. And I would say that, like, you know, rule number one of quantitative social science is patterns exist in human behavior, right? Rule number two is just because a pattern exists doesn't mean an individual follows it. And I think rule number two hasn't really been arrived at yet in some of the fields that we're talking about.
That seems like a good place to leave things.
We'll leave you with the big questions.
Well, Ruman, it was wonderful catching up with you as always. We'll have to make sure to do it more frequently.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me on, Sam.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. For more information on today's show, visit twimmelai.com/shows. As always, thanks so much for listening and catch you next time.